granted, too, we also used our own company's APIs. This thing was just like a monster. It was like not even as cool as a transformer. It was just kind of this blob saying, "Kill me." But it was a great app to build and demo and stuff.
Machines are so fast and stores are so big that they give us plenty of latitude to screw things up.
The shell, or which is the name we give to the command interpreter.
So the operator got a pair of tweezers and very carefully fished the moth out of the relay.
Because you've all read The Mythical Man Month.
And the best motivator in the world for programming is scratching your itch.
Developers, 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 developers.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sourcecraft Podcast. My name is Byung, and on this show, we talk with the people behind amazing dev tools and developer experience. Open source authors, maintainers, DevX engineers inside forward-thinking companies, developer advocates and educators, founders of dev tool companies, anyone and everyone who brings joy and delight into our lives as programmers. We talk about their work, we talk about their lives, we talk about their vision of what lies ahead for the world of code. Stay tuned. All right. Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Sourcecraft Podcast. Today, I'm here with Cassidy Williams. She's the Director of Developer Experience at Netlify. She's also a prominent educator and presence in the React open source community, who has helped many people get started in web development and coding in general. And prior to that, she held developer advocate and senior engineering positions at CodePen, Amazon, Clarify, HackerFund, and Venmo. And last but not least, she also has a great Twitter account, which I'm sure a lot of listeners are probably familiar with at this point. It's very popular. She posts a lot of funny and on-point videos about developer life. Cassidy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And for the intro, I feel like such a big deal suddenly.
You are a big deal. I think, what is it? You have like 170...
something like that. I should probably pay attention to like metrics more for whatever reason. I almost never look at that number.
Yeah.
When I do, I send it to myself in a Slack message to be like, yes, you looked at this number, and I've one of those that's just been going for years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably a good thing. I mean, I feel like you just focus on, you know, doing good stuff, and then the kind of numbers follow that. You don't seem like the type of person who's primarily driven by fame or recognition or that sort of thing.
No, mostly out of laziness. I feel like if I really wanted to be more famous and get like certain numbers of hits and stuff, I'd be just stressed all the time and trying to like optimize, and I cannot be bothered.
Yeah. Cool. Well, to kick off the conversation, you know, we always like to start with, you know, how people got into coding. I know that you've kind of told the story on a couple of, you know, podcasts before, so maybe we'll just breeze through this time. But just to set the scene, you know, young Cassidy Williams, how did she get into the world of code?
So when I was born, there was a keyboard that appeared in my hand, and I knew just that is not true.
Fully formed from the head.
It just happened. Yeah. I was birthed, and I said, I know C++. I actually didn't have a super highly technical family or anything. This is something that I discovered when I was in eighth grade. I was about 13 years old. I was walking home from school, and I heard someone say, check out my website. I was like, oh, you can have one of those. And then I went home and just started looking up how to make websites. And back then, there were not nearly as many resources as there are now. There were not all of these great website builders where you can drag and drop and all that jazz. And so when I was learning, it was a lot of me looking at hitting that view source button and looking at a bunch of websites saying like, okay, so this tag means marquee, which means it'll move. This tag means bold. This tag means this or that. And so slowly but surely, that's how I taught myself HTML, CSS, JavaScript. And it was me like making websites from my biology class in high school and slowly but surely kind of just building my skills that way. And then in high school, when I was getting towards the end, they had an AP computer science class, and I was like, oh, I can learn this for real and with an actual teacher.
Awesome.
That and yeah, it kind of went from there. From there, I went to college and started working. And that first class was also the first time where I realized that women weren't really in this field, especially at that point. I had no idea that it was kind of a boys' club, where I walked into that class. It was, I think, my junior year of high school.
Yeah.
And the teacher went up to the front and said, well, as you can see, we have a girl this year. And I was like, what?
Oh,
and
my gosh.
That is when I learned. And it's been bumpy ride since then, but it's been
yeah.
fun.
What was the kind of reaction to that announcement? Was there like a hushed silence and everyone turned to look at you?
It kind of was. Or? It was mostly wow. everybody just turning to look at me. And I was like, hi. I was significantly more, like, I'm fairly introverted, but I was significantly more shy at that point. And so having any sort of eyes in my direction was a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I feel like it almost like sometimes it's like, it's better if you don't know going in, because then you're just like, la, 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 you know, like this
yeah,
stuff is cool
well,
and there's no...
I think it was. I'm grateful that I only found out later, after I had decided I already liked coding, because there is nobody to tell me otherwise. Because it was after I realized it where suddenly I started seeing, like, even other girls who took like different electives and stuff, they'd say, now why did you take that one? Because girls don't take that class. And I was like, nobody told me this.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I just like computers.
Yeah.
I feel like if I had known that there was such a gap before, it might have discouraged me in some way. And so a lot of what I like to do to this day is try to encourage younger girls to get into, or at least try coding, because if they like it, there's so many opportunities, and I want to get to them before the world does.
Yeah, that's awesome. Coding is so much fun. I feel like every kid should at least try it. It's like at
especially because you can get so creative with it when you're not thinking about just like, how can I optimize this linked list, but like especially now, like if there's like Minecraft, you can learn how to code by just modding Minecraft and stuff.
Yeah.
I've seen kids who've gotten really dang good at Java just because they were excited to play around with Minecraft and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there's so many opportunities now, and I'm jealous of some of these kids today. Kids
they don't know
days.
How good they have it. It's, you know, it's funny how substantial the gap is, I feel, between the folks who kind of get into coding through, you know, their own volition versus the mm-hmm. ones who kind of get into it through the, you know, traditional educational system. And maybe we'll go into this later when we talk about programming education. But it's like, you know, in college, there are all these like so-called weeder courses where like you got to prove your mettle to, you know, learn how to code. And it was all like, you know, SICP, you know, Lisp, you know, like very
straight up assembly sometimes.
Yeah, assembly. And then I talked to, you know, a lot of folks who got into programming. A lot of them are like, you know, really talented, you know, senior engineers. They've written a lot of amazing open source projects. Like, how did you get into coding? And I think like it's like 60% of them are like video games. Like started playing some game and then wanted to mod it, or, you know, stumbled upon some community that was like playing around with it. And that was kind of the vector in.
Yeah, that and Neopets. Because Neopets, I like rediscovered my account sometime last year. And it, first of all, that website, oh, it's painful. Oh, man.
Explain what Neopets were. Because I bet there's maybe some younger listeners who don't
know. I'm sure there's some folks out there who don't know. So Neopets was a website where you could have a pet, a virtual pet. It was called a Neopet. Mm-hmm. They were all very cute and stuff, and you could play games with it. You could give it different outfits. You could name them, and it was honestly amazing. It was social media before social media, where they had so many. It was definitely geared for kids, but I was able to like play around making games for the first time in Neopets. I was able mm-hmm. to learn a lot of HTML and CSS by playing with Neopets, because they had tutorials on the website saying like, if you want to customize your guild, here's the tags that you need to use.
Nice.
And then like what was it? Oh, yeah, they even had like art classes where it was just like, hey, you want to draw your pet? Here's the steps for how to draw it and stuff. And it was such a great website at the time. And I think a lot more people than we realize got started with Neopets for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, Neopets were a huge thing. It's hard to describe how big it was.
I guess I know, like that and like Gaia Online. That was a really big one. I think that was when I was in like, I think that was like sophomore year of high school for me when that was particularly big.
Yeah.
But yeah, people making avatars, playing with HTML and CSS, finding their place in the world.
Awesome. So you kind of dove into this APCS class. You're the only girl, and you made it through. You got into college, and what was like? What at that point were you kind of like questioning yourself? Because like all of a sudden you were like, cognizant of this like big imbalance, or you're like, nah, you know, screw that. I'm doing this computer science thing.
Yeah, it was a bit more of the latter. I was like, yeah, I can do this. This will be fine. There are some things that happened along the way. One of the stories that I told on Twitter recently was like I remember going to career fairs, and I remember specifically there was one company where I went up to them and I was just like, hey, I'm a computer science major. I noticed this posting doing, you know, your 30-second elevator pitch or whatever. And yeah. The guy said, you know, you're a little too well-spoken. I'm going to put you down for sales instead. And I was like, oh, no, I don't know sales. I'm a computer science major. I'd want to do the software developer position. And he was like, no. And he took my resume and wrote sales on the back. And he just kept pushing it. I was like,
wow.
I'm not going to go for an interview for a sales job. I'm looking for a software job. And he was insistent. And every single year after that, and their company would sometimes present at student organizations. They always came to the career fair. Whenever he would see me, he would say, there's my sales girl. Come over here. And I'd be like, whoa. No, that's not what I do. And it's just one small thing of many ridiculous things that I had to deal with in college.
That's so patronizing.
Learning these lessons. Yeah. It was so annoying. I remember with the computer science club, it was a pretty big org for all the computer science majors at my school.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of revamp it because it always like started off big, but then like five people would come every week by the end. And I was like, let's change that. And my sister was also a computer science major. Some of our friends were, and we were like, yeah, let's go for the leadership. And we all happened to be girls. And one of the professors was just like, are you sure? I mean, why don't you give the boys a chance? Why are you trying to do this?
I'm
like, are you kidding me? You would not say give the girls a chance if it was a group of guys running for this. Yeah. And by the way, we did end up getting to run that club, and we had a mix of guys and gals, but like we were able to keep it steady at between 100 and 200 people coming to our club regularly throughout the year. And
I mean, the results speak for themselves, you know.
It does. And we made sure that representation mattered. But anyway, I did have a few incidents and instances of that kind of stuff, but I like coding a lot, and so I didn't fully let it stop me. Yeah,
that's awesome. Never let the haters or the detractors or the questioners stand in your way. I think that's
and luckily lesson. I've been privileged enough where it's not been necessary for me to step away. I know there's definitely some folks that I know who have left the industry for serious reasons in this particular regard, but
yeah.
And
that's a loss for us
on.
All. Think of all the great software that's not being built because
I know
talented people decided to exit the industry.
Yeah, because it's tempting sometimes. but yeah, I feel like a lot of software engineers in general, men, women, and everyone in between are just like, maybe I should take up woodworking and leave all of this behind when you have those particularly stressful days.
Yeah. Go out in the mountains, completely disconnect, and live the simple life.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that you were introverted as a kid.
To this day. The pandemic has really amplified that, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, that resonates with me because I think I self-identify as an introvert as well. But you know, I've always felt like I wouldn't have guessed that, you know, given, you know, all the stuff that you put out, given the fact that you're like hilarious.
Thanks.
And as I understand it, you're also the mascot for the college sports team.
I was Cy the Cyclone for Iowa State. It was awesome. I mostly just wanted to try on the outfit. I was like, oh, that kind of looks fun. I just want to know what it's like.
Yeah.
And then it turns out the person who was the mascot before me graduated. And so I ended up being the mascot all 4 years of college.
Really? All 4 years?
Yeah, all 4 years. Yeah, that's the job I've had the longest, I think, outside of babysitting. But I wasn't the... So there's multiple costumes, and this is actually at a lot of schools, which I didn't know, you know, until I was one of them. There's usually, like, an athletic costume, because you need to be able to do flips in the costume and do all kinds of stuff where, like, at the football games and stuff where you're really chanting for people. And then I was the one where I did everything that was, like, not athletic. So I would walk around campus passing out water bottles. I would kick off races. I would be at Winterfest and the state fair and stuff like that. It was a blast. Inside of the costume, so they were just like, okay, you have to be at least 5'9 to wear the costume.
Okay.
And I was just like, I qualify. Let me.
Check.
Done. And they're just like, okay, yeah, we could give you $9. And I was like, yes, minimum wage. Let's go. Or it was $2 above minimum wage. Very exciting. You get like a bodyguard because people try to tackle the mascot all the time. And so they don't like, that's a thing. Luckily I was never tackled, but people would like pull my tail behind me and stuff a lot.
Wow.
It's very hot in there. It's so, so hot. And inside of our costume in particular, there was just full on like hockey pads around my shoulders and stuff or and that kind of gear to make me look bulky.
Yeah.
And then like a straight up football helmet underneath.
Oh, wow.
And
okay. So you were.
Yes,
it was all for your protection.
Padded out. In the winter, it was amazing because I would just walk out in just the costume and it was great. But the summer, it got hot. There's a little fan in the head that sometimes works, but it didn't all the time. And you're supposed to take the head off every 15 minutes just so you can get a good amount of oxygen and put it back on. And I remember there was one time at the state fair where I like told my bodyguard, I gave her the timeout sign so that way I could go take the head off for a little bit. And this is August in Iowa. It's hot. Humid.
Yeah.
Like all that corn is just like breathing at you. And it was a very, very hot day. And I remember she was just like, okay, one more picture. And I was just like, okay, fine. And then I woke up. And I had completely just passed out at the state fair in the giant costume. And I just remember, like, they were taking the head off of me, and I was waking up as they were taking the head off of me. And there was a little kid just standing there who's, like, maybe 4 or 5, and who's like, I didn't know you were in there. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm barely conscious here. Ah! And, oh, man, that was a memorable experience. Most other experiences were very fun wearing a costume. And I remember I had a classmate that I knew was afraid of mascots, and he didn't know I was the mascot. So I just chased him on campus one time.
He was afraid of mascots.
Yeah. Like, that was just like, I saw him avoid me regularly because and he had like mentioned at one point, he's just like, yeah, no, costumes just kind of freak me out.
Oh no.
And so of course I have to chase him. He was fine. Hopefully not traumatized or anything, but I had a blast doing it. It was kind of a fun way to like be silly while being anonymous, because there would definitely be times where people would come up and hug the mascot, be just like, Mike, I know it's you in there. And I'm like, I'm not allowed to talk in the costume, but I'm not Mike.
Are you not allowed to talk? It's like completely silent.
Yeah, they had like the Ten Commandments of the costume, and I don't remember all of them, but the main two that I do remember was that I wasn't allowed to talk, and I wasn't allowed to pick up a child.
Okay, child probably for liability reasons.
But why
no talking? Is that
is it to like maintain
the illusion of Psy?
Yeah,
got it. Interesting. So I was envisioning it as this kind of like meet and greet type of thing, but you weren't actually like talking with anyone. You're just
Lots of waving. Whenever like no one was around, I was just supposed to like dance in the middle of campus. And so for a long time, it like affected me outside of the costume, where if nothing was happening and I was waiting for a bus or something, I'd just start doing like my dance. And then I realized I'm not in a costume. I can't just start dancing silently waiting for someone to high five me. But yeah, it was a great job. It was really fun.
Do you think it made you more extroverted, or was that like kind of completely separate?
I think so. I do think that like speaking in general is a very practiced skill. It's something where now, because I speak on podcasts and give talks and teach classes and stuff, like I'm fairly comfortable doing it. I still am introverted. I still am one that, like, after I've given a talk and have talked to people afterwards, I'm exhausted and want to go back to my room. But I think it's just one of those things where I started practicing it more. And so I mentioned like the computer science club. I started speaking for my computer science club when I was in high school. I would try to like help out middle school kids with coding. When I was in college, I tried to help out high school kids. And then when I was out of school, I started trying to help college kids and so on and so forth.
That's awesome.
And so I think it's just a matter of over time, I was speaking enough where it just worked out that people perceive me as confident.
That's awesome. I mean, it sounds like you're very motivated by like wanting to help others, kind of like level up.
That's by far my favorite thing. I really love seeing that aha moment when people are trying something out for the first time. I'm just like, okay, so here's the trick, and they're like, you can do that, or they're just like, oh, that's how that works, and then they just take it and run with it. I love seeing that spark and figuring out how I can show people how to do something so they can do that. It's my favorite thing to watch people be the best that they can be and learn and everything, and I love facilitating that.
Yeah, and I feel like communication and just being able to like teach someone something, it's one of the most like valuable kind of combo skills with, you know, being good at development, right? Like there's a lot of I don't want to say the word synergy, but you know, like there's
it's
a lot of
synergy,
like,
just say it.
When I hear that word, there's like that one movie, In Good Company. Have you ever heard that? Where like they bring the suits in and they're like, we're going to set a new direction for this company. It's all based on synergy. And it's like very like, anyways, but like there is this kind of like mutual compatibility between like being technically deep and also being able to communicate that to others, especially, you know, folks who are not as, you know, expert in a particular domain.
Yeah, it's something that I have found so valuable for myself, and I've seen it do such great things for so many people. Because if you're a good coder, great, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. You can develop great things. But if you can code and explain what you're doing, then you can become a mentor to your team. You can level up and start leading directions more. Communication leads to so many career opportunities, not just in the workplace, but also externally. If you wanted to give talks, if you wanted to teach, if you wanted to do so many things, it's a lot of people say it's a soft skill, but I prefer the term core skill. Where it's a really core thing where the more you practice it, the better you're going to be at it. And like even with job interviews and stuff, that's something that I think you can practice. And it's really communication, often more than coding, because a lot of people will probably do perfectly fine technically in any given role. But can you communicate that to a job interviewer? And not a lot of people can.
Yeah, that's a whole other skill set. I think especially every student learns that. It's like, you know, ace the test, have a solid command of the fundamentals, but then you walk in there and someone's asking you to like reverse a linked list on a whiteboard and you're like,
what was that? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I do think though that practice does make perfect, and as cliche as it sounds, where if you do want to get better at communicating, better at interviewing, even better at coding and all this stuff, it's really just continuing to do it and building up that muscle.
Yeah. Would you say that's one of the reasons why you're kind of drawn to this role of like developer advocate? It was kind of like a newish role around the time you were graduating. No, it like wasn't as like common as it is now.
It was very new when I was graduating, and I'm so grateful that I learned about it at that point, because I first started checking out hackathons back in like 2012 or so. Okay. And they were still very new then. It was more just like people are coding in a room, and it started getting bigger and bigger over time, and the hackathons got massive for a while. I don't know if they will ever hit that peak again after the pandemic, but I was very much in the thick of the very big hackathon scene and stuff, and it was talking to people at these hackathons and talking to the company reps at these hackathons where I was just like, oh, so you're a coder, but you don't just code, you go to these events. This is awesome. Mm-hmm, and I got connected to Rob Spector. And for those who don't know who Rob Spector is, he basically, I might be giving him a lot of credit, but honestly, he kind of created the dev advocate role for the first time, where he was at Twilio, and Twilio kind of created the dev advocate role, which is why I'm saying it. And he did this role there where he was speaking, he was building demos, he was going to hackathons and conferences and meetups, and he was making all of this great stuff. And I was just like, I want his job. That looks so fun, because as much as I like coding, the fact that he's able to help people at the same time and he's able to make fun things and do like R&D type stuff, that sounds amazing. And I stayed in touch with him and a few other people who I do consider mentors. And Twilio, at that point, they had started like, it was kind of a dev advocacy training thing, but it didn't last very long, I think, just because of the time commitment. But they were just like, okay, we want to have you practice speaking, have you practice writing, have you practice building short demos and stuff. And so I was a part of this initial program. It was called Twilio Heroes. I think it lasted maybe a month or two, and it was just this little thing that I did my senior year, and I was like, yes, this is what I want to do. This is awesome.
That's awesome.
And again, it didn't last long, I think because like they realized, oh man, if we have to teach all this stuff, we also have to grade them and give them feedback on all of these blog posts that we suddenly have to read and all of these talks we suddenly have to watch. It was that was good on them for trying, but for me, it just helped me make so many good connections with people that I still talk to this day. And my first role out of graduation was a dev advocate role, where I was, because it was still weirdly defined, I was doing like product engineering at the same time, but I was also representing a company at hackathons, conferences, meetups, writing blog posts, and going out there a lot.
That's awesome. Say more about hackathons, because in those days, like, hackathons were just becoming a thing, and then my sense is that there was like a peak, and like these days it's no longer like as big of an activity, but like what was it like in kind of that heyday?
In the heyday, I've been to over 100 hackathons. I met my husband at a hackathon. I've been to a lot of hackathons, and I was deep in them in that heyday. I was the admin of a group called Hackathon Hackers on Facebook that had, I think we peaked at like 60,000 members, and it was,
holy cow,
all talking about hackathons. Yeah, I was deeply involved in it, and it was a blast, honestly. Like, looking back on it, we probably overhyped them, but it was such a cool way to get to know so many people so fast. You stayed up all night and stereotypically had your pizza and your Mountain Dew and just were hacking on things, and it wasn't like hacking into things, but hacking things together and making just fun, silly projects and apps, and it was a blast, honestly. Like, I think PenApps got to like 3,000 students. Yeah. I think that was the biggest one. And MHacks was also really big, too, at University of Michigan. Man, there were so many. And again, my husband and I, we met at a hackathon. We weren't like, he didn't like hit on me at the hackathon or anything. We got to know each other outside of it, but we met each other there. And for a while we were dating, we would do hackathons together, where like he would do the back end, I'd do the front end, and we'd whip projects together as fast as we could. And it was so much fun, just so many fun prizes and interactions, and it was truly just chaos. And I both like miss those days, but also I burnt out so much in those days, because especially because, again, with the roles that I was on, both at Venmo and then my next job was at a company called Clarify. I was their first dev advocate there, too, with my sister. We were doing like the product engineering by day and then the hackathons on the weekends. And so I was just working 7 days a week regularly all the time because there were so many hackathons to go to, which I don't regret it now. I loved that time and I learned so much in that time, met so many great people. But oh my gosh, there was so much overworking. And it was very much people like, hackathons are the future. You have to do it. And you don't have to do it. But at the time, I was one of those people. I was just like, this will be your fast track to your career. And pros and cons. It was a good time.
I mean, any sort of like event planning, I think there's just like so many moving pieces. And then the hackathons, there's like another dimension, right? Because there's a whole, like, how does it, there's a whole process for like getting all these like different people, most of whom you haven't met each other, in together, get them to get along, get them to meet each other, get them to kind of like feed off each other.
Get them to code together. Yeah.
Get them to code together. Ensure that the environment is like welcoming to people of all backgrounds. Like, I'm sure, like, what did you learn? Like, what were there like takeaways or like, you know, trials by fire that,
plenty.
what were some of the, like, yeah, like what were some of those?
You know, that was also the time where everyone was realizing events need a code of conduct. Mm. And we were definitely like, I have been at so many events where we did have the code of conduct, where we didn't have a code of conduct, where we realized we needed code of conducts. And people are very hard. More difficult than code to deal with humans. And and like the whole inclusivity aspect, I remember there was this one hackathon where we were going to have like a women in tech meetup at it. And there was like some Facebook post saying, hey, let's go hit on the women there. And some women were messaging me the post saying, I don't know if I'm comfortable to go. And I posted in the group saying, hey, just so you know, this post isn't okay. We wanted this to be an inclusive group for everyone, blah, 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 blah. Then the people were mad that whoever posted it, I still don't know who they were to this day. They were mad that I did that, and they took my phone number and spread it to a bunch of places and made some fake dating profiles of me, fake Facebook profiles,
seriously?
Fake GitHub profiles. They were harassing me over text, and they were just like, take the post down now or you're going to regret it, like super threatening type of stuff.
Wow.
And I was just like, does this event have a code of conduct or something? And they didn't. And the organizers just had to say, okay, we'll make an announcement that this isn't okay. And I'm like, great, but they're still texting me and just stuff like that. And so there are some harsh lessons learned in those olden times in that regard. I say olden times as if it's like decades ago. This was like 5 years ago. Then also, there was all of that, but then also just kind of learning to optimize, okay, sponsor booths, we need to make sure that there's a place where sponsors can go, but then also get people to use their APIs. Handling how to handle submissions to make sure people actually submitted stuff during the time period and they didn't work on it ahead of time. How much do you want to go deep into the projects in the demos? Do you want to just see the demo or do you want to look at the code? Because that might get kind of gross. And so many different things. Even having showers nearby, that was something that was a very harsh lesson.
A lot of these things are overnight where like you don't, like people are there the whole time.
And you, like the demo halls, you're like, oh, well, it smells a little like something in here. We should have had the showers open during this so that people could go take showers during the hackathon. Yeah. And so
got it.
Anyway, it's lots of learning experiences, both physical, mental, emotional, probably spiritual, at these events. But, It was so fun. It was very much chaotic good, in my opinion.
Nice. Do you think we should bring them back? Or like, you know, I guess even before that, like, why do you think they kind of crested? Or like, why isn't it as big of a thing or like as hyped as it once was?
I think, so first of all, people just
obviously
got
now COVID, but yeah.
Yeah, obviously now COVID. I think COVID definitely put a stop to a lot of things. First of all, online hackathons started to get more popular. I think a lot of companies, there's just more platforms now available for that kind of stuff. And I've noticed quite a few companies who used to sponsor the in-person ones. They're just like, you know, we can get just as many hackers, if not more, if we just made an online hackathon. And so there's some element of that. I think there's an element of health where people were just like, we can't be having students stay up all night eating junk food and coding in our hallways and stuff. I think there's elements of that as well. And I mean, a lot of these hackathons still exist. And honestly, I would probably go hang out at one and code if someone would let me, just because I did genuinely enjoy them. They're just like, you old woman, get out of here. But I do still genuinely enjoy them. But I think it got to a point where people were just like, there has to be a better way. And there were. There are so many better ways to showcase that you can code outside of doing it all night at a hackathon.
Yeah. I think, you know, one question I've heard is like, how do you get something like done in that short amount of time? Like, do you go in there with a game plan, like already having thought about the problem, or...
Well, because some hackathons, they didn't release the themes or prizes or anything until that day. And so it varies. I rarely went in with a plan. I probably should have a few times. But I did do some hackathons while working and stuff. Actually, fun story. Okay, so there was one hackathon that I did, and it was with Joe, who's my husband now, but we were dating at that time. And then two of my co-workers who worked at like my company's parent company. And so they were like not my direct teammates, but I generally worked with them. And so it was us just chickens. We were like, hey, we're not going to be working at this hackathon. We're going to hack. It's going to be great. And it was a TechCrunch hackathon. And TechCrunch, super big. We were just like, okay, yeah, how about we come up with some kind of project that uses every single sponsor API? Because then we could probably optimize for winning prizes. Yeah. Let's go. And that's so awesome. We did the all-night thing. We went around to every single sponsor, talked to all of them, and figured out a way to build a project using all of their APIs. And when it came to demo time, I went up there, I demoed our application for the team, we showed how it worked. We were just like, okay, yay, great. And we went back down. Turns out one of the sponsors of this hackathon was a competitor to my company.
Ooh.
And we had used their API. And here I am as a dev advocate of this, of my company, representing another company's APIs. And the PR team was so mad. And myself and my coworkers, like, we suddenly were getting all these calls, and we were just like, okay, we just have to hope that this doesn't get a lot of visibility, because we don't want like you people to be showcasing our competitors' APIs. This is such a bad look for us. We're just like, okay. And so we like went into the crowd and kind of hid ourselves and just let the other demos go. And then of course, because it's a TechCrunch event, our hackathon gets on, our project gets on the front page of TechCrunch. We're just like, oh, yay, and oh, no, oh, no, but also yay. And we're just like, okay, what are we going to do? And meanwhile, the PR team is messaging us. They're so mad at us because it just kept getting more popular. And we ended up winning the competitor's prize. And then which was even worse, we won the competitor's prize and then like two other prizes. And once again, we're like, yay, but oh no. The PR team, they had someone come take myself and my coworkers and put us and hide us in a room because they didn't want us to take pictures with the competitors who were supposed to be giving us our prizes. So Joe, again, the then boyfriend Joe, he just had to go collect all of our prizes for us. And he was just like, I promise this is my team. I wasn't the one demoing. They're in the bathroom and stuff. And oh my gosh, it was the most chaotic time. We were not allowed to compete in hackathons after that.
That's hilarious. You know, I almost feel like, you know, I get where the PR team is coming from, you know, to an extent. It's like, you know, you're there to represent the company and, you know, your goal is to get people using, you know, our API or whatever. But at the same time, it's like there is this long game that it's better to play with people, right? Where like we're just there to like, you know, help people.
Friendly competition is good.
Yeah, exactly. And it would have been weird if you included like every other company's API except that competitor. That would have been, I feel like that would have rubbed the audience the wrong way. It's like, you know, is this a true, like in the true hackathon spirit, or is this like a, you know, marketing ploy, you know, and it makes it feel very, very different.
Yeah, and granted, too, we also used our own company's APIs. This thing was just, like, a monster. It was, like, not even as cool as a transformer. It was just kind of this blob saying, kill me. But it was a great app to build and demo and stuff. But
Sorry. Hold on.
Oh, he just took off his headphones. Wow.
I leaned back and disconnected my headphones.
I thought you were just this joke went too far. I am taking these off. I'm done.
It was everything, and
the That's heyday awesome. Of hackathons was a chaotic time. It was great.
Okay, so this was like first job out of school. You were in this like or was it?
This
or were you
one
still in college
was
at this point.
No, this one I was out of school. Was it? It's either my first or second job out of school. I think this one was my first job. Yeah.
Okay, got it. And you, my understanding is that you held this like weird dual role. You were like a dev advocate, but also a senior software engineer.
Or not senior at that point because it was my first role. Just software engineer. Yeah, yeah. And so I was working. My first job out of school was Venmo, and so I was working on the actual Venmo product. I built blocking in the app, the first iteration of blocking. So if you ever want to block someone from paying you, watch out. Also, I worked on or I helped contribute to the emoji autocomplete stuff. So because like you know you can type
that's the
rent
best feature. Yeah,
it's great. Yeah, if you type various words for poop, that was me. So watch out, like turd.
Awesome.
That brings up the poop emoji because of me. So I've basically built all of Venmo. But
I mean, at this point, you probably had a non-trivial impact on whatever viral growth coefficient they track. You know, I feel like the emojis, they're engaging.
Yeah, it was a coworker of mine who came up with the concept of it, and then he was like, "I need people to help me name emojis because I don't know what to do." And I immediately jumped to the poop emoji. I did other ones, but the poop one is my legacy for sure.
Awesome. So, what was it like being both dev advocate and software engineer? Was that like half and half, or
In theory, it should have been. As someone who believes strongly in work-life balance, it should have been a half and half role. But instead of 50-50, it was definitely 100-100. And I was just working two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
And kind of like what I was saying earlier, I just burnt out a ton.
Yeah.
I remember there was a point where I had spoken every day for 14 days in addition to working.
Wow.
And just, it was... I burnt out so bad, like physically. I flew to Florida to hang out with my grandpa and be offline for a week because I was just down and out. I don't recommend that. It's a very fun thing in concept because you can be like, I'm super technical and I'm doing dev advocate stuff. La, la, la. Don't do it. It's not worth it. Do one or the other and really commit. But that's what I did, and that was actually what I did with my second role too, and that was at a much smaller startup. Clarify, my sister and I, we both started at the same time. We were the 17th and 18th employees at the company, and so we were starting the DevRel org, plus I was their first front-end engineer, and she was helping be a founding engineer of the back-end team too. And so like between the two of us, we had a lot to do, and dual roles, they sound great in theory, but you really gotta focus on just one if you want to be successful at it.
Yeah. I have to
say, not
for
be
someone...
successful at it. I'll interrupt myself and you just for a second. Not successful at it if you want to not burn out, and I'll leave it at that. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, for someone who believes in work-life balance, you seem to have taken on a lot of roles that required very long working hours.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't listen to me.
Is this one of those do as I say, not as I do?
One of those things. And granted, I have gotten a lot better at it. I do not take on dual roles anymore. I have learned that lesson the hard way. But yeah, I mostly learned by doing, and please learn by listening from me, because
this is one of those things that I struggle with, because you know, I meet like people earlier on in their careers. I have a younger brother who's coding, and I'm thinking about, like, you know, what advice I should give to him. And I think, you know, similar journey. Like, there were parts earlier on in my career where I bit off more than I could chew, and you know, definitely had to, you know, sacrifice like personal life and like sleep and things like that. And I've kind of learned my lesson. I try not to do that anymore, because it actually is counterproductive. But it's one of those things where it's like, do you have to go through that to like understand what the boundary is,
right?
Or like, what is it? Because like how do you?
Because I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It's awful. But at the same time, I learned so much from it. Yeah, because here's a very, very clear and a very clear example on this. In college, there was a semester before I went to go study in Spain where I was just like, oh, because I'm going to be studying Spanish in Spain, not computer science, I should just take a ton of technical courses. And so I took 21 credits of all technical classes. It was a mistake. I slept maybe 3 hours a night, if that. Oh. Often it was 1 or 2 hours a night. I almost went blind. The whites of my eyes turned gray. I literally was losing sight in my right eye and had to like go to doctors because of it.
Oh my God.
It physically messed me up. Thank goodness the Spaniards have siestas and stuff. I recovered very well there. But like, it was a very, very bad time. You should not do that. And then, meanwhile, in my last semester of college, I had like a regular workload, and I was much more chill about it. I was just like, I've accepted a full-time job. I'm just gonna try to pass these classes. I'm not gonna try to go for the A pluses or anything. I just gotta pass. I got some of the best grades I ever got throughout college that semester. And that just shows, if you don't push yourself to the limit, if you just try to be steady about it, just try to do your best without killing yourself, it really works, and you can do really well. And so, once again, clearly I didn't learn that lesson and had to go through a couple jobs where I burned out super hard, but now I have really been trying to internalize that, because it's the stress just isn't worth it.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so you're very early on dev advocacy. You were kind of helping these companies get usage of their APIs. At some point, you got into front end development. At some point, you got very much into React. What was that path like? What was the thing that got you into React? And you know, I guess, why did you fall in love with React? Because it's kind of your framework of choice, right?
It is, and I've been using it for way too long, honestly. React came out, I think, in mid 2013, and I started using it in 2014, and so I've been using React for a long time. I've seen some things with React, but so when I first started at Venmo, when I was doing the product engineering side, I was actually a backend engineer, so I was doing Python and Django and working on APIs and stuff, and honestly, the front end just looked more fun, and it reminded me of like my eighth grade days of hacking together websites and stuff. And so after working on front end on the back end for a little while, I basically just asked if I could try the front end team for a little bit. And it turns out the company was forming a new team, and it was going to be a new internal tool product, and they needed front end. And I was just like, cool, I'll do it. And so I was kind of forced to learn React, because they were just like, this is the new hot thing. We should use it. That's honestly how I got into it. I started learning React, and the docs were decent at the time. And we started just kind of building that project. And the more I learned, I started to give talks on it. And I started to be just like, okay, here's how the virtual DOM works. This is what the component lifecycle is. And I think it got so ingrained in me in my early career that it just has stuck with me ever since, where I really know the ins and outs of React. And I don't mean to say it like in a bragging way, like I'm the best. I mean, I know this because I've been through it, and I've seen how certain things are implemented, and I've looked at the source code when I have questions and stuff.
Yeah. When you're teaching people or like helping people like get into React, what are some of the like common misconceptions or like pitfalls that you notice?
So,
if there are any, or maybe, yeah.
It definitely varies from person to person, but I think what a lot of it is people have used React, but they don't understand it from the fundamentals of it.
Okay.
And again, when I was learning React, there weren't a lot of tutorials because it was new. And so I was kind of forced to learn it from the fundamentals because that's what I had available to me. And so often when I teach React, even if people are senior engineers, I do start from the very fundamentals. Like, okay, there's React and there's React DOM. Here's the difference between the two. React Native is similar to React DOM and how it renders things. Mm-hmm. Okay, because of how this deploys to the page, let me compare JSX to JavaScript. Like I go really, really low level at first and then bring in things. And one of the things that I always try to teach when teaching React hooks, for example, is I implement use state from scratch. And I show how use state is implemented to be like, this is why hooks need to be written in a certain way because of how the reconciler works. And granted, it's like hacky and not a perfect implementation of use state, etc. But it just to show people, okay, here's how React works from these fundamentals. It's really a lot of understanding how JavaScript works with like flavors of React using JavaScript that way. And I think it, at least just based on what I've seen so far, it's been effective because then people can take what they already know about React and be like, oh, wait, okay, now I know why I always put hooks before I make any if statements or something, and so things aren't blocking the main thread and in how the reconciliation works and stuff like that. And so I think understanding it from that perspective, it's definitely very computer science-y, and that might be my background there, but because it's much more of a theoretical perspective. But I think when you understand how something works, you understand how to use it a lot better.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess, you know, going back to, you know, an earlier part of this conversation, we were talking about, you know, CS education, programming education, getting into it, you know, start with the fundamentals. There's kind of like the, you know, the spectrum. Some people are like, start with the fundamentals. That's important. Lay a solid foundation. I'm caricaturing here, but like, you know, that's one end of the spectrum. The other end is like, you know, throw the fundamentals to the wind. Let's just like focus on building something cool. Just build, hack it together. When you go about like teaching people React specifically, you kind of move very quickly to the fundamentals.
Right. Yeah. And I think just hacking it together is a great way to just try, but I think it's a very good introduction, but it doesn't, you can't get to the next level of understanding. You can't get to that next level of understanding without knowing the fundamentals.
Yeah, makes sense. And then you really kind of do want a teacher or guide there because
it's
hard to find the right path on your own.
Right. Even if you just have a good community, I think community is a very underutilized tool in the tech industry. But if you have just a decent group of people who can answer your questions and you can answer their questions and stuff and learn from each other, even if it's just using them as rubber ducks and talking out certain issues, it really makes a difference in how deeply you can learn something.
All right. I'm going to shift gears here because we're running low on time. But I think, you know, one thing I'm curious about is, like, how did you get such a big Twitter following? You know, was it just, like, being awesome and, you know, putting out awesome developer-related things, and over time you just, like, built this audience? What is the Cassidy secret?
I would love to say that it's because of my contributions to the tech community and all of the technical work I've done. It's the memes. That's what it is. And like I told you that like with Twitter followers and stuff, I messaged myself on Slack, and that was because that, like, granted, I didn't have no followers before making a lot of silly videos on the internet. I had a decent amount, but it definitely grew exponentially beyond that once I started making more jokes and stuff. Because when I was first using Twitter, I was mostly using it as like a bookmarking tool for myself, where if I retweeted something, that meant I was going to read the article later. And then eventually I was like, I should probably share my own thoughts on these, shouldn't I? And so I would post about conferences, about work I was doing. And then, again, somewhat decent following. I think I was starting to get close to like 20,000 followers, and I was happy with that. And then in 2019, it was July 2019, there was a thread that came out about how people should be hiring 10x developers and how 10x developers are key. And they're just
Gotta get those 10x ones. 9x, not enough.
And it was, it had such unreasonable expectations of people being just like, a 10x developer doesn't believe in teamwork. They just build and stuff like that. And I was like, I need to make fun of this. I don't know how, but I want to. And I got the app TikTok. And I was just like, I heard that that app has a good video editor, and TikTok's video editor is great. And so I got TikTok and made just a little video making fun of the 10x developer thing. And people thought it was funny. I was just like, oh, that's fun. And I was just like, man, I jumped up quite a few followers. I'm going to message this to myself on Slack. That's kind of crazy. And then because I kept watching TikToks, I was like, I could turn some of these into tech jokes. And so then I, like, the next week I made some other tech joke about, how it's impossible for your code to work on the first time. And it was people singing Impossible from Cinderella. And, again, got another a bunch of likes. And then I did another one the next week. And it was mostly just me kind of having fun on TikTok making tech jokes. And within 2 weeks, I gained 40,000 followers on top of my existing 20.
Wow.
It was rapid, and it was very intimidating, and I was starting to really need to mute a lot of DMs and things. It was a lot. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, no, I think within 2019, it was so many more that I the sheer volume of people that came my way, I'm very grateful for, don't get me wrong, but it was definitely overwhelming. And it's still something where I'm sometimes like, I really want to tweet this snarky joke, but because there's so many people, I have to be careful.
It's
because
the internet.
It's the internet. People will take things a certain wrong way, and so you have to like think about how you're going to word anything that much more, because even if it's something that might be completely innocent, just like a funny silly joke, they're guaranteed I get DMs about it, and it's it's a very,
someone's
very
offended, or they take it the wrong
thing.
Way or
and like, even I have a weekly newsletter that I send out every week, and consistently when I send out my weekly newsletter, there's always someone who's not happy about it, and I'm like, this is a free newsletter for people to practice interview questions,
and they contact you about it, be like, I didn't like this thing that you
like how I worded a sentence. Like, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. And, even this past week, I had a crypto company sponsor my newsletter, and I got messages about how I hate the rainforests because of that.
And because the whole, like, environmental, like,
impact of crypto and stuff.
Got it.
Yeah.
I see.
And so, anyway, It's been a learning experience. It's a blessing and a curse to be able to be around so many people. But anyway, I'm grateful for it, and I mostly just, I'm not trying to be like I'm amazing, but I do try to use the opportunities I've been given and the privilege of a large following to try to make a difference in people learning more and getting more opportunities.
Yeah, that's great. I think, the content you put out is really good. I think, generally it's like, it's funny, it's engaging, but also like super on point. And I think it helps kind of guide a lot of people into like, oh, like, you know, here's someone who's, you know, like a developer in React, and she's very relatable, and being a developer is fun. Being a developer is, well, it's fun, but also like, you know, aggravating in a funny sort of way.
But we can bond in our pain.
Yeah, exactly. So to recap, key to a big Twitter following, memes.
Yep. 100%.
In order to make good memes, you have to be funny. So I guess my question is, How does one become funny?
Being teased a lot as a kid? No, I'm kidding.
Really? Think, is that it? Is it?
No. That was probably a dark joke that I shouldn't have said on a podcast. Honestly,
we just
okay.
need to tease our kids more. No, just
yeah,
kidding.
Easy, done. I've actually given talks on how to be funny, and I'll summarize them because otherwise I could talk about this,
cool.
and we simply do not have the time.
Yeah.
I think whenever you are in a conversation with someone, there's an opportunity for either a pun, a rhyme, or a one-liner.
Pun, rhyme, one-liner.
If you just continuously practice that, as you're chatting with someone, start to just, as they're saying something, think about how you could turn it into a pun, a rhyme, or a one-liner. Always, always execute on it. Sometimes it will flop completely, but then over time you get better at it, and people start to expect that from you. There are certain things that I say that people laugh at, and it's not even a funny joke. It's just that I'm consistent about it. And it works. And you can come up with one-liners for yourself, like one that I always use is, oh, that was my nickname in high school. And it's a very small one that by itself, it's not that funny. But if someone is just like, oh my gosh, this code is so difficult to work with, like, oh yeah, that was my nickname in high school. Little things like that. It kind of makes a conversation funny, and it keeps your brain kind of working because you're just like, how can I turn this into something amusing?
That is amazing.
It works, really, and it's something you can practice.
Whenever someone is like chatting with you, as I am now, there's just like this always on background thread in your brain, just
yeah.
like pun, one liner, or just like
always
being.
It's constant, and once again, blessing and a curse, because you sometimes want to say jokes that are not appropriate for the situation, but it works, and it works well.
Yeah. All right. Shifting gears again, because we're running low on time, and there's just so much to cover. But developer experience at Netlify. You're the director of developer experience at Netlify. Talk about what that role entails. You know, what do you do day to day? What are the things that you think about? And what is that like?
Yeah. What do I do? I do something. honestly, at this point, I have learned that the director level equals meetings. And so it's a lot of meetings very regularly, making sure everybody's in sync and stuff like that. And I don't mean the band. I'm talking about, you know, syncing together. And so when I'm not in meetings, it's a lot of trying to figure out, okay, how do I make certain types of development easier for developers. And so before I was at this position, I was mostly focusing on React. I do a bit more other frameworks and stuff, depending on what we're focusing on as a team at any given time. But if there's some kind of thing in the platform, I try to figure out, okay, is there something that I can do that makes it easier for these developers, whether it's a demo or building something, changing something, having another meeting? Is it something that one of my teammates can do where I can assign it to them? Or is it something that I have to do? And that's what a lot of it is, and it is really fun. My team is a blast to work with, mostly because they also are really funny and do a lot of puns and one-liners and stuff. And that's a lot of what I've been doing lately, where it's just kind of improving experiences and trying to fit in coding whenever I can.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, your previous role, you were a React instructor. That was, like, hands-on, right? You're effectively
an individual
contributor.
Yeah, so that was a full-time traveling job where I was going and teaching workshops all over the place. My last workshop was in Dublin, Ireland, and that was at the very beginning of March 2020. And then I came back, and I was going to be home for 2 days, then fly to Spain to teach a workshop, and then the pandemic happened. And all travel canceled after that. Yeah. And so I was teaching all over the place. And honestly, I do kind of miss that job. Unfortunately, again, you can't really travel in a pandemic, and people were not as into online workshops at that point. We unfortunately had to lay off all staff, including myself, within 2 weeks of the shutdown. Like, just everything dried up, all of our future plans completely dried up. And, I miss it. I miss being able to interact with developers in person and showing them things, but we'll get back to some world like that someday, maybe. And it has been fun seeing all of the really rapid advances in being able to chat online like that.
Yeah, it is cool to see the innovation, but same time, like, wow, what a kind of whirlwind journey it's been.
Yeah, it really has. It's really hard to believe that it's been more than a year and a half even. It's time flies when you're having fun, when you're stuck at home.
Yeah, seriously. I was going to ask, so you're director of developer experience now. That's a people management role, it sounds like, from what you describe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like, how has that transition been? Because, you seem very like the classic sort of thing, which, I've also kind of like struggled with. It's like, you're in a meeting and, you see a pun that you want to make, but maybe you're like, maybe I should let my team make that pun.
Or I know, right? Yeah. No, it's definitely a lot of that. And I still get to do some IC work, individual contributor work, but it's definitely people management role. I have four people reporting to me. And a lot of times it's me saying, okay, what blockers can I get out of your way? I do that and then let them fly and do their work. And in some aspects, I'm like, ooh, it's kind of nice not having to do this myself. There are people for that. That's cool. Yeah. And then other times where I'm like, I miss coding. That being said, because I code a little bit less at work, I code more on my side projects and stuff just to kind of keep the muscles going. It's a very different role. It's the kind of thing where it's almost like more focused teaching, but it's less teaching and like figuring out, okay, what is this person struggling with? How can I get them to use their education budget? How do I get them to trust what we're working on here? How do I get them to understand the roadmap and that kind of thing? And it's a very different mindset, but it's been a neat learning experience.
Totally. I was just thinking someone should create a hackathon for all the people in the world who used to do a lot more coding and now
miss it.
Just like come together for a weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be like a lot of people being just like, I don't remember how to use that.
How do I set up my developer environment? That'll be like the entire weekend.
Yeah,
like,
just keeping MDN docs constantly opening. Like, what do you mean JavaScript split takes this?
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the end of the time here. I wish we had like another hour because I feel like there's just so much more we could talk about. But thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was fun to hang out.
Yeah. Just as a quick parting thought, do you have any kind of like future predictions about web development? Where it's going to head in the next year, or like, big new things on the horizon that people should check out after listening to this episode?
So I heard a hot take recently, and I think that it's a very good one, where it was that I think it was a tweet or something where it said zero config means R config. And so you don't want to always trust when platforms or frameworks or things say it's zero config, it just works, because it just works until you want to move outside of their opinions. And so I think the trends will be like, yes, lots of zero config or low config type of frameworks and things, but with escape hatches and highly configurable options. And one example of that, for example, that I think is going to be pretty big is the Astro framework. I've been really impressed with it so far. I don't think they've hit V1 yet, at least at the time of recording. And it just works out of the box and lets you use React, it lets you use Vue, it lets you use Svelte and Preact and a lot of state management solutions and stuff out of the box and just works. And then if you don't want it to just work, you can cut things out. You can say, okay, I don't want you to be able to render Vue. I'm not going to use it. I want my packages to be smaller. Just render React or something like that. And I really appreciate that about them, how they're like zero client-side JavaScript shipped to the browser unless you enable it, and everything else is fully configurable. And I think it's a very big indicator of the future. Like I know 11t kind of has elements of this, and Slinkity is being built with 11t to do similar things, and I'm seeing a lot of that as a theme popping up, where it's something that's so flexible that you can use whatever libraries you want and it'll just work. Or you can say, I want you to be very cut and dry and work in the way that I can figure. So anyway, that's the direction I'm seeing and the trends that I'm seeing. And I feel like that's going to get much bigger.
Interesting. Very cool. Is that astro.build? Is that the
Yes, astro.build. Mm-hmm. And okay, what I cool. like about it too, and this is more on their developers than anything, is it's from the creators of Snowpack, and their next big version is actually cutting Snowpack out, and it's going to be using Vite and WebAssembly and stuff under the hood. And I really appreciated that they were just like, you know, we know that we like our own tools, but we want to use the best tools, and sometimes we want to use something that we didn't build. And I respected that about them for being humble about that and letting ego aside and building something cool with that. So anyway, I think Astro is the start of a bigger movement in this direction.
All right. Well, Cassidy, thanks so much for being on the show and taking time out of your busy schedule. Really appreciate it. And this was a ton of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It was a good time.
The Sourcegraph podcast is a production of Sourcegraph, the universal code search engine, which gives you fast and expressive search over the world of code you care about. Sourcegraph also provides code navigation abilities like jump to dev and references in code review and integrates seamlessly with your code host, whether you're working in open source or on a big, hairy enterprise code base. To learn more, visit sourcegraph.com. See you next time.